into it, Carolyn?
Sure.
Well, Bob. Could you explain the Ten Thunders of Finnegan's Wake?
No.
I knew you would say no. Why, Bob?
You claim you don't have it on record?
I don't have the Ten Thunders explained, and I've never gone through them.
Well, the first thunder is on page 3, and it contains references to all the early technologies, like speech, fire, early weaponry, early forms of clothing, I guess, earliest technologies. It would be basically Paleolithic man becoming Neolithic man. Okay? And then the second time...
So that's not really attuned to the three or four major forms of communication McLuhan has talked about. Oral.
Oh, yeah, we can get into that, but that it is related to that. But hold it, there's 10. You're going to have to raise 4 to 10.
Right.
But okay, will you stop? Stop interrupting, Gary. We'll get into that. Just remember, that's another topic.
I'm dialoguing, Bob.
Right. Well, you got to learn how to dialogue. You don't interrupt or bring another topic. And
well, I don't understand. You just went over speech so fast.
Yeah, I'm just giving you a sketch of the thunders. That's what I'm going to give you. Okay. So the.
But it doesn't include. So the first thunder does not include written or electronic. Only speech.
No, not writing. Not electronic. It basically is speech. But you could have early caveman drawings or some early form of writing.
Mainly speech.
Yeah, you could contain all the early...
Can you recite the word? Or
well, it starts off Baba Baba, which is, the babble of speech.
Can you recite any more of it? Give us some key...
No. So,
Move along to number 2, Bob.
Yeah, so what was it? There was another point there about the... It's nomadic man, okay?
What's nomadic? The wanderer?
Yeah, they don't have settlements yet. They haven't really got into villages and towns.
Okay.
Tower of Babel?
Yeah, that's implied, yeah. So, that's the first thunder, page 3, which is the first
page.
Like
that cricket right now?
Yeah, which is the first page. And then, it's acoustic space, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Deep, dark bog of the acoustic space. And then, the second thunder is the beginning of, it's on page 23, that's in the section on the prank queen. And the prank queen is the beginning of visual space. And you have beginnings of piracy and exploiting and pillaging and creating wealth reservoirs. And then clothing comes in as social weaponry. So clothing is now become fashion or aggression. Aggressive act of clothing. So before that, you just had non-visual man. He was not visually designing himself. Second thunder starts to bring in the visually designing levels of social organization, social power. Okay.
Like, so it made man competitive. The fact that he's starting to wear clothes.
Yeah.
And is there any keyword?
Not wear clothes to use them as social weaponry, as status symbols. Cleopatra, say. Egyptian times.
And is there any key phrases you could say, one or two, that relate that to the second thunder?
Well, it begins Percode Husk. That's the first syllables of the second thunder, Percode Husk.
Well, I know what a husk is, but what's a Percode? Oh, a pair of coat?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a husk, like husk.
Yeah. So then the third thunder is on page 44, and it begins clicka clacka clicka. And
railway.
What?
The railway.
We'll hold that thought, because there's two levels of doing it. It does refer to the railway, but you've jumped up pretty pretty far from Egyptian BC times to the 1800s. So it means the beginning of cliques and priests and organizing society around. You have the beginning of settlements, okay?
And religion?
Oh, yeah, religion is always there. But this is the beginning of settlements and Neolithic man with cliques running society, whatever form of a social hierarchy there is. So you have clique, okay? Mm-hmm. And then the fourth thunder. Fourth thunder is on page 90, and it starts off bloody awful Mecklenburg. And it is now medieval, say, where you have medieval towns with lots of mud and agrarian life and beginning of market gardens and truck gardens, not trucks, but carts and oxen and delivering foods to a market, you know what I mean?
And so the wheel is an extension of the foot.
Yeah, the wheel is established itself in that situation.
What's the words? What's a few words in this
bloody one? Awful Mecklenburg. B-L-A-D-Y. Bloody. Bloody awful. Angful. Machel. Bloody awful Mecklenburg.
What's bloody referring to?
Bloody. B-L-O-O-D-Y. Is one of, they refer to many things, but that's...
Bloody, and then what's...
Bloody awful Muckletown. Mucktown. Yeah, you know, those old Hollywood movies of medieval times, you know, with mucky castle zones, Monty Python kind of scenarios.
And Napoleon really introduced mud as the fifth element?
Well, he was joking on the scientists looking for the fifth element. They were trying to find the fifth element for the periodic table, and he said, well, mud's the fifth element.
Is mud, what do you refer to mud as in your third album?
Well, we'll get to that. That's the tenth thunder. Okay.
It is?
Yeah. Now the...
So there's some mud here and some mud later?
Oh, yeah. All the thunders assume and resume the others. Okay? Because they all resonate with each other. So that was thunder four. And then you have thunder five, which begins, thing crookly exin every pasture posture. And it ends... mind looking down at it. Now this is the beginning of industrialization and the prostituting of women, or the scourge of prostitution, the early industrial displacement of community, and it takes place on page 113, which is a key section of the book, because on page 109 Joyce on that page spells out his technique, and those pages 1, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 have a lot of stuff in there, and including talking.
What stuff?
Well, much meat, much themes, many themes, and Joyce...
That is the whole meaning behind Finnegan's Wake?
Some of the meanings, yeah. He spells out a lot of the meanings in that section. And in that section you have Belinda the Hen digging in the midden heap and finding the letter, which is a symbol for Finnegan's Wake. And it was the mud as thick that was ever heard dump. You know, that t-shirt slogan I have. So this midden heap, this mud thick, this letter in the mound, and the hen gets it and it's all scratched and looks like Finnegan's Wake. So that is the fifth phase of the domination of visual space. And that's the industrial age of the photo, the newspaper, photo and press and assembly line reproduction. So Belinda the hen, who makes many eggs, lays many eggs, is a symbol for industrial man, okay? So the first five thunders have taken you from Paleolithic man, moved you through Neolithic, through medieval up to industrial man, up to the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have five more thunders. That last one, the fifth, was on page 113. Then you have a big gap. I mean, you had five thunders from page 3 to 113. You know, in 110 pages, you had five thunders. Then you have to go another 144 pages to get to page 257, where you have thunder six. And its opening words are Lacadorn, Lacadorn. And it refers to the metamorphosis of visually biased man, the reorientation of visually biased man with the introduction of electric environments. The sixth thunder is...
Wait, this is the sixth thunder you're defining?
Yeah, page 257.
But define visual, first of all, what you mean or what he means by visual.
He means visual man is controlled by woman. It's controlled by matriarchy, and it's symbolized by the prank queen. I mean, during visual man, as you get more and more into the visual phases, man takes over and becomes a patriarchy. But really, woman controls him. And woman is a symbol of visual space. He is visually hypnotized. He is fragmenting and separating his extensions of himself to create the leading up the Industrial Revolution. Then,
but can you define visual space? Because sometimes people are misled by that term.
Well, it's an extension of the functions of the eye.
Okay. So.
Which fragments, separates, and rips and tears. As opposed to the ear, which is implosive and unified. And the symbol of man under prank queen rule is Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, who is the man who has the initials HCE, and he is an egg.
Here comes everybody.
Right. And he comes, here comes everybody. He's like the visually homogenizing of all man. That was extremely developed in Gutenberg Galaxy from 1500 to 1900, okay? So the phases of the prank queen visual space controlling the new womanly man, which is HCE, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, he's an egg who has been broken. He's Humpty Dumpty who has fallen off the wall. The wall is another metaphor for visual space. The wall is the beginning of removing people from the nomadic, acoustically oriented first thunder phase of technology through the later technologies where people get walled into little settlements, then villages, then towns with the castle wall around it.
Mm-hmm.
So the wall is the extreme development of is a symbol of the extreme development of visual man, a man with borders for the center and a margin. So Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, who was a organic, holistic, complete egg man back in the Baba phase of the first thunder, in the dark of acoustic space, he lived in primordial emotion with fear and sensitivity and ESP. As he gets more visualized, you crack the egg. So Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker falls off the wall, right? Mm-hmm. All the king's men and all the king's horses couldn't put him back together again. That's all the failed religions and politics and ideologies and superstitions and concepts that ruled man in that period, but in the end could not put Humpty Dumpty back together again. What put Humpty Dumpty back together again is outlined in Thunder 6 to 10.
You're still on 6, though, right?
Yeah. I was just giving you an overview there of explaining visual space. So,
And did you give us some words from number 6?
Yeah, Lacadorn, page 257.
Lock?
Lock doors. Lock doors. Now, what this means, the sixth thunder is going to give the general pattern of the reconstituting, putting together, reunifying of Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, the egg. All right? And in this case, the egg is put back together environmentally with the electric retrieval of acoustic space and the final extension of our central nervous system, which is tactile, and the extension of the holistic form of the tactile sense, which is electricity. And that integrates Humpty Dumpty back together again. And Humpty is back together again, he's no longer controlled by the prank queen. He's no longer hypnotized by visual space. You can even see puns on prank queen hypnotizing and Finnegan's Wake. You can see puns of the prank queen hypnotizing Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, that particular word used by Joyce in Finnegan's Wake. I think it's hypnotized, a pun on make happy, hypnotized. hypnotized. So,
it's a cross, it's like a combination of hypnotizing someone with happiness?
Something like that. I'd have to get the actual quote. And so the sixth thunder is a transition thunder, which leads into 7, 8, 9, and 10, which briefly, 7 is the beginning of the radio, telegraph and radio era, the first electric technologies.
Word.
Then, just a minute. Word?
Well, give me the words.
No, I'm just giving you an overview to go back to explain number 6.
Okay.
So 7 is radio. Number 8 is the wedding of sight and sound, the silent movie with the radio talkie, the radio soundtrack, the radio acoustic space. So you have the integration of sight and sound again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Thunder 8. Thunder 9 deals with the technologies of the airplane and the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And Thunder 10 is Thunder dealing with television. So those are the last 5 thunders. But number 6 gives the general pattern of the metamorphosis caused by these electric technologies I just ran through. It is the thunder of exits and entrancings on the Phoenix Global Theater. Now, Phoenix is a pun on the Phoenix Playhouse, is the term used in Phoenix Wake, and it's a pun on the Phoenix, the bird Phoenix, mythical bird that consumes itself in fire and then is reborn. You know that bird?
Well, I'm learning it. You know,
yeah. Right. So the pun on the Phoenix myth is the reconstitution of the electric environment, which revitalizes the Phoenix Theater. An electric environment is basically a fire environment, an environment like the element fire. And so as a result of the Phoenix Theater being changed, you have new characters coming on stage and old characters from visual space being ushered off stage, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you have new entrances, or entrancings, right? Entrancing figures that entrance.
Mm-hmm.
And you have new exits. And it's a time of tribal retrieval, occult retrievals, and revolutions. He makes a lot of the Russian October Revolution of 1917 in this section. And it revolves around Buckley, the soldier who shoots the Russian general. But the Russian general is a pun on the technology of movie rushes and the light, the world of the movie and the camera, which is the rush in general, or the mass man. It's a variation on Here Comes Everybody. It's a mass man which is shot by the sniper, and the sniper is the symbol for the camera projector onto the screen. Anyways, that's one of the multi-levels. So in Thunder 6, which begins Locked Door, you have the closing of the old theater.
Okay.
And you have the beginning of the new theater, which is locking down mythic stages, I call it, or retrievals of previous media, previous happenings, previous historical events, previous styles of culture. And these lock themselves down in the electric metamorphosis and battle with each other. They fight the Battle of Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
So the locked door on page 257, the sixth thunder, gives the style of endless replays and tribal replays of the collective unconscious, of aspects of the collective unconscious, as figures, as actors on the new global theater stage. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So then Joyce goes through the various electric technologies as they arrive, and he begins in Thunder 7 with the words, both all characters, or it's both all coracters, or both all coractors. What you have is that both the ancient visually space dialectic, the dialectic of visual space, now is subsumed in the electric tactility, so that what was polarized dialectic becomes both ends of the pole. They flip-flop.
Mm-hmm.
So Shem and Shawn, the two sons of HCE, are twins.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're both capable of all characters, or all spectrum of of the human anthropomorphic dimension.
Uh-huh.
So the this is the effect of radio, a telegraph and radio. And I can't remember if it's, I think it's the seventh thunder or the eighth thunder. He ends off saying, "Man's turn up." It's now man's turn up. And man has been freed from the control of woman, or mm-hmm. the control of visual space. See, in the visual space period, men looked like they were controlling, but they were controlled, hypnotized by the extension of visual space, which is symbolized by the prank queen, or the woman who numbs man in the visual space era with her nudity, mm-hmm. or with nakedness. So this is like Freudian, you know, the mother and the Oedipus and all this stuff is an approximation of the technological causes that Joyce lays out of how visually biased man was controlled by woman. But when the electric environment makes everybody discarnate, and Joyce uses the word discarnate, fitting his weight, when electric environment makes us out of the anthropomorphic polarity, in a sense you could say the polarity is between the male and female. And when both become all characters, the male and female become interchangeable. The male and female anthropomorphic images are interchangeable. And that's the turn of the 20th century. And so you have characters like Duchamp running around in women's clothing, right? And that was pretty outrageous. And Oscar Wilde and these guys. So the beginning of the sexual revolution happens with the turn of the century, when the electric age of telegraph and radio moves in.
What's the relationship say? Was Oscar Wilde one of the first guys to do this?
Well, he was well known. He's a publicist for the gay life, right?
But was he actually gay?
They say he was.
Oh, so was...
He was put on trial for being gay.
Okay, was Joyce writing about this before or after him?
Oh, Oscar Wilde, he died about 1900, 1905. He was a biggie in the 1880s, 1890s.
Oh, okay.
1870s, 1880s. And so anyways, both all characters are not just the dialectic of visual space. It's also the dialectic of the battle of the sexes. So both become all characters. So men and women are interchangeable because they're discarnate now and don't have the biological difference when they're wearing the electric environment, okay?
That explains why Bob is a woman.
Yeah, that's right. And so at the end of that thunder, it says man's turn up. And that means man is free from the control of visual biased history. So therefore, man takes over politically and culturally. And politically, it was Hitler. Culturally, it was showbiz, you could say. All the modern electric entertainment media.
Entertainment sucks.
Yeah. Entertainment sucks syndrome. So males took advantage of that. And if you think of the period of the 30s and 40s and the radio era and extreme, you just think of war and men running amok, right? It's hard to think of women's reality other than they worked in the assembly lines and the factories, right? They were kind of liberated and they got out of the home, out of the protected mechanical bride pedestal they were on in the 19th century, the Victorian era, and they became that was the beginning of the suffragette movement and they wanted to vote. They started to work in the old factories, right?
And they were the nurses.
Yeah. Well, Florence Nightingale was the first hero of the electric age. She was the icon of the telegraph. And she was the first, she was the symbol in the first Vietnam War. First Vietnam War was the Crimean War in the 1850s. Out there in the fringes of the Western empires in Turkey and that area, mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, those regions, the war between Russia and Britain. And that war is a key metaphor in fitting his wig. That's where the charge of the Light Brigade happened. And the charge of the Light Brigade is the metaphor, the symbol Joyce uses for television and also the electric information environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first Vietnam. That was when people reading the first telegraph reports by a reporter back to London, where people read about the horrors of war on the front back at home. And the McLuhan said the genius of Florence Nightingale is that she figured she was a rich person, rich aristocrat who was upset by this new electric implosion of the telegraph and invented a new role for herself and I guess for women, which was the nursing profession
mm-hmm.
on the front. So that was the first Vietnam, the first colonial war that was telegraphed back into the homes and upset the young people.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, in the seventh or eighth thunder...
What thunder was that all you were talking
both
about?
Both all characters of seventh thunder on page 314. The sixth thunder is on page 257. And then the seventh thunder is page 314. Both all characters. Both all characters. And it ends with man's turn up. And
okay, you're still on seven. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So would you agree, Carolyn, that the image of the 30s and 40s is the image of man running amok?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, okay. So then the eighth thunder begins Papa's Appears. Papa's Appears. And this is a continuation of the theme of the radio thunder of both all characters, where a man's turn up continues and Papa's Appears as a political maniac, and that's Hitler. Papa's Appears, and also all the radio Papas, Stalin, the radio chieftain of Russia, Churchill, the radio emperor of England, British Empire, Roosevelt, the radio emperor of the United States, and you could include
the Italian guy.
And yeah, Mussolini, the radio emperor of Italy, and Hitler in Germany, and you could even say Mackenzie King in Canada. He reigned for a long time. So those were the new iconic and new culturally defined iconic images of Papa's Appears in the movie radio era. And this was the talking movie, which came in around 1927 when you put the radio soundtrack to the silent movie. And that's The Wedding of Sight and Sound. And in that whole section, you have the parable of Kersey the tailor making the wedding clothing for the Norwegian captain who's going to marry a... I can't remember whose daughter, marry the daughter, you
mm-hmm.
know. There's going to be a wedding, and that's an anthropomorphic image of the wedding of sight and sound technologically, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the movie contains all, it contains all anthropomorphic times and spaces of history. It's not the mosaic mesh of a TV cathode ray tube, okay? Which is a bunch of dots. Human beings don't look like a bunch of dots. So the last medium that contains stories and replays and represents in big elaborate scenarios or scenery all the cultures of the past of the anthropomorphic man, you know, you could say visual space man, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or even back pre-visual space to acoustic space, you know, the Sheiks of Araby, right?
Shake your booty.
Yeah, shake your booty. So the movie is The Eighth Thunder. That's page 332. Okay?
What's the beginning word again? Something appears?
Papas. P-A-P-P-A-S. Oh. And then it goes A-P-P-E-R-A-S. Papas appears.
Okay.
Papa appears. And it's the beginning of pop art and pop culture.
Mm.
I mean, that's what Warhol replayed. He replayed the pop culture. Where, you see, education in the 19th century was run by women. They were the teachers. They were the ones who brought in Oscar Wilde and the poets and created the literary salons and sponsored in their bourgeois lifestyle. The men are out working and the women are dealing with parties and social life and cultural education and setting up schooling for kids and that.
Mm-hmm.
So the women in the 19th century ran the art scene. But in the 20th century, pop culture and pop art took over because pop ran the culture scene. Pop got in the act, and mom was put aside. All right, so that's the real meaning of pop art. It was a hidden ground in before World War II. Isn't that neat?
Does Andy Warhol know that?
No, he doesn't know that. He didn't.
None of
he
the,
wouldn't tape Marshall. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but some of those pop artists must know that.
Well, they.
Do you know of any?
Let me tell you something. Do I know of any?
Like Rauschenberg or any of those, some of those guys could have read Joyce.
No, here's what they read. The pop art scene showed up in the middle 50s when they started to do it, and then it kind of became popular and 10 years later in the early 60s, all right? But the very first pop art exhibit named by either Clement Greenberg or Harold Rosenberg, you know, the famous art critics of the 50s and 60s, you know them, right? You know Rosenberg and Greenberg.
That don't ring a bell, but go ahead.
Anyways, that's what you study when you study modern art history. You read their writings. And one of them named the first pop art artifact, or first pop art exhibit, was Marsh McLuhan's Mechanical Bride. Came out in 1951. He was the first to present ads as pop culture. And then, as McLuhan pointed out...
What's your source on that?
Oh, I know. Well, I've read Rosenberg. I know he said
it. Okay.
And,
I know which book you're talking about exactly, with the pop can with, like, the little lips on it.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it might have been Greenberg. I don't know which said it. But the interesting thing is that in his last interview we have on tape, a very rare interview, Marshall talks about popular culture. This was done in 1979, and he pointed out that all the great artists, or the successful artists of our time, came out of advertising agencies. Because advertising was where the real talent was, and the real modern art form was advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, he put advertising in another medium. That's how you make something an art form. You take something that's a ground or a figure, and you put it in another ground.
Right.
So he took the real art of our time, the collective art form of advertising, and put it into a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first pop art exhibit for the culture vultures, for the world of the world of commercial capital A art. Okay. So I bet you Warhol and all these guys happened to see Mechanical Bride, or spin-offs of it, or McLuhan's Explorations, which talked about that stuff. And that may be, if this is not on record, that may have been how they get some of their ideas, or how they got out of the conceptual bias of art up to that time, the abstract expressionists and all those movements, first part of the 20th century, which were philosophically oriented things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Warhol took the ultimate, what was called cliches, and put them in the museum, which was outrageous at the time, right? Campbell's soup can. This was done first by Marshall. He was the first one to give, like, serious art criticism to the world of ads.
Hmm.
Now, Joyce knew this because, remember, the main character in Ulysses is Leopold Bloom, who was an ad salesman.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so the references to advertising in Finney's Wake are very well marked out by Joyce. It's one of the few parts of the book where he has the word Jimes, J-Y-M-E-S, where he talks about himself, or James, you know what I mean? So Joyce knew the role of advertising.
Wait, I don't understand that. He's talking about himself. What does that have? He's advertising himself.
There's a section that's marked off as an advertisement, and it has the word Jimes in it, capital J-Y-M-E-S.
Which is you mean he's self-promoting himself?
Well, no, it's a clue, the fact it's the only time he uses a word very close to his name, James. It's Jimes, which is the way Irish say James. Jimes. Okay? So, it's a clue. And it's in the part that refers to advertising. So anyways,
this is still number 8, right?
Yeah, we're still talking about... I'm digressing here about McLuhan and advertising. Oh, pop culture. See, pop culture was the fact before World War II, and then it was replayed as an art form, and it was called pop art, which was dealing with advertising images, all right? Campbell soup can, promotional commercial images, was put into the gallery. The first pop art, or turning advertising into art form, exhibit was Marshall's book, The Mechanical Bride. So these other guys started doing it, and the key fact about these guys, a lot of them, including Zappa, came out of advertising agencies. Because if you're in advertising, you learn a lot about what's really going on in the molding of commercial design and commercial life, the real Orwellian world of advertising.
And the psychology of persuasion.
Yeah. And you're working with external space and visual and internal space. So McLuhan pointed out in this 1979 interview that all the successful artists come out of advertising agencies. It's a generalization, but Warhol came out of advertising.
That's right.
A lot of them did. It's surprising.
Yeah.
You go through them. And even on a slight level, Zappa worked in advertising. So So what you have is advertising is the real art form of our time, and those who want to split off into the specialist ancient art form of painting or exhibiting in galleries, you know, fragment themselves, retrieve and prop up the world of commercial fine art, and they drop out of advertising into that little sub-world. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And Warhol was the guy who seemed to express the ambience of that, the ambiguousness, because he didn't care about what he made in the... He wasn't so enraptured with the content of the art he produced in the commercial gallery world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he always played off in the interval between that and promotional art or advertising, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was the best symbol of promoting oneself there was as an art form. So he replayed the pop art, replayed the fact, the ground of the pre-World War II world of the Eight Thunder where pop art appears, right?
Mm-hmm.
And pop art really is not just some fine art. Pop art basically in the pre-World War II era is the whole entertainment world of Tin Pan Alley, swing, all the content of radio, serials and soaps and comedy. You know, the whole American entertainment scene was the
comic books.
Yeah, they were part of it. Comic books were made into radio drama, detective fiction, police stuff. All that was called popular culture. Was created in the radio environment. Radio movie environment, okay? So it was a fact, a social fact, a ground, a content ground in the sense. The real ground was radio and movies. But on the content level, it was a new genre of entertainment. And that was the popular culture of the pre-World War II period. That was turned into art form by the beatniks and hippies and Warholians, okay? All right?
Okay.
So that was
number eight.
That was number eight.
What's the words for number eight again?
Papas appears. The first few words.
What about the end words?
I don't know. Okay. The main ones to remember: man's turn up, which is either on the end of Thunder 7 or the Thunder 8. I think it's Thunder 7. So then the ninth Thunder deals with the other amazing technology of the first part of the 20th century: the Wright brothers in the airplane, and Ford in the automobile. Those were technologies that really changed the world. So Joyce uses in that, and this Thunder, this is, we've done page 314 is Thunder 7. Page 342 is Thunder 8, or page 332 is Thunder 8. Then you go almost 100 pages, and you get to 414, and that's Thunder 9. And Thunder 9 is the one about the car and the plane, and it begins with the words, hasten, hussen, kaffen, coffin, which means the haste and rush of urban life in the early part of the 20th century when the automobile came in and when the airplane came in,
mm-hmm.
creating auto exhaust pollution, coffin, creating death on the highways or on the roads, creating the death of the mafia starting to take over in the cities, and creating the coughing of smoking, the coughing of the automobile engine, and the caffeine coffee world of the cities, okay? So the rush and speed and death of the cities brought in by the car and the airplane is in the first four sections of the Ninth Thunder. Hasten, hussen, kaffen, coffin. Right? Or caffeine, coffin.
Okay, wait. Let's pray.
The Ninth Thunder,
is
hussen... Hassan, hasten, hussen, hasten, kaffen, kaffen, hussen, hasten, kaffen, kaffen, or okay. Hustle, haste, much
haste. Haste makes waste and you end up in the coffin.
Yeah, haste makes waste, you end up coughing from your caffeine, and you end up in a coffin. So, in the 20s and 30s, you had the airplane, the car created the suburbs. So the car turned the city into a ghetto and created suburbs. Then the airplane went around both
the city and the suburb, making both ghettos. So the cities were in the period of crisis. This is when the gang wars were running amok. The city was obsolete, so the gangs took over the clubs and the entertainment and the politics and the liquors and what the entertainment consumables. So Joyce, and this is on page 414. So Joyce uses the fable just after the thunder 9 on page 414, around page 418 and 419. He has the fable. He does a synopsis of the fable of the ant and the grasshopper. And the ant is the car, and the grasshopper is the airplane. And he has the battle between these two media. And he also makes a subplot, the battle between James Joyce, who's the grasshopper, and Wyndham Lewis, the ant. Okay, so he does a whole thing on that, as well as the battle between the car and the auto, or the car and the airplane. So that's the ninth thunder, and then the tenth thunder is television, which is on page 424, 10 pages after the ninth thunder, and it begins "Allo Turd." U-L-L-O-T-U-R-D, Allo Turd. And it refers to the post-visual, post-acoustic, tactile man.
And what's turd? You mean T-U-R-D, like a turd?
Yeah, we're going to get that. You asked about the mud? We've come back to the mud. Allo Turd. Hello.
TV is shit?
TV is what is called the murky, muddy wake of tactile man. Now you have man is no longer anthropomorphic. He's no longer acoustically controlled or visually controlled. He's controlled by the raw central nervous system, which is an extension of the tactile sense. Therefore, he is blind, dumb, and deaf, and he has to operate by pure instinct and feeling in this new environment he's swimming in. And it's basically very hard to get perspective on it. So it's a muddy environment. And the pun of turd is T-U-R-D becomes toured, T-O-U-R-E-D, the tourist. In the movie car, airplane, radio era, the world was the oyster for Western man. For a large part of humanity, they could travel anywhere on the planet. That was when the global village happened under Thunder 7, 8, and 9. So the tourist conquers space and time, and it flips into its opposite, which is television, where the tourist is sent rather than having to go someplace. The environment comes to the tourist. Okay, so hello toured or hello tourist is television talking to the previous extensions:
mm-hmm.
Airplane man, car man, radio man, and movie man. So the global village made the world your oyster, but then the world was wiped out and propped up as a theater under the impact of television. So Allo Turd is a reference to the muddy wake, the tactile environment of feces like water, and that's also pollution. Starts to make people aware of industrial environment, the old content, which becomes looks polluted, so it becomes shitty. And in that sense, it's a pun on shit or turd, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pollution sensibility increases under TV. It also is another level. It refers to Ford, the guy who invented the automobile. So it's another way of satirizing the previous industrial, the last phases of the industrial environment. The car, the automobile invented by Ford, because the automobile is like the movie. It combines the mechanical and the electrical. And, you know, a wheel, mechanical engine, but it needs the electric spark to make it go, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the movie is a mechanical visual thing, but it's also got the electric acoustic factor. Okay?
Okay.
So So L.O. Turd refers to the tourist, to the shit, and to Ford. So it's like a new, it's like the television environment goes around all the previous thunders of the electric era, 6, 7, 8, 9, and swallows them and says, hello, and swallows them up, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the 10th thunder is the murky, muddy, tactile wake of visual man, creating post-visual, non-visual man, mm-hmm. with music as its anesthetic content. Everything becomes musical, including politics. And music becomes politics. So that's the 10th thunder on page 424. Every thunder has 100 letters, except for the last thunder, which has 101 letters. And the next paragraph after the statement of the 10th thunder says, has a character saying, there's that 100-lettered word again. Tribal myths from all cultures. He uses languages, which is a great store of mythic history, mythic stories. So he would use all kinds of languages to refer to all the different cultural fables that we look at now in retrospect as the history of culture. And so myth is both a figure in the ground in Phineas Wake.
Why does the book actually start a third into the book?
A third into?
Like a third into it, the story actually starts.
No, where'd you get that idea?
Someone told me you read it.
No. Well, a third of 628 pages is
well, approximately
is 210 page. Or 207.
Maybe the third is what's wrong. Maybe some fraction into
the story does not have a beginning, it does not have an end, and it doesn't have a middle. Every page is the whole story as well as a part of the story. And you know the book is circular. Now, the interesting about Phineas Wake is that it's circular. The last page and the last sentence on that page 628, merges into page 3, which is the first page of the beginning of the book. So most people see that as a cycle. But the cycle view of history, or of pattern recognition of ancient tribal institutions, is the content of the Electric Age, because we cannot totally retrieve the occult sensibility, or even you could say astrological sensibility, of the cycles of nature, because pre-literate societies were non-linear and they had a great sensibility of the cyclical patterns of nature. That's a characteristic of Finn. The thing about Finning's Wake is it points out that in the 20th century you have a cyclical replay of tribal sensitivities as content for the simultaneity of electric space, which puts all times and spaces in touch with each other, rubbing against each other, which is not cyclical. Simultaneity is different from cycles. Cycles have a sense of duration. There is no duration when everything is in touch with everything under electric all-at-onceness.
Mm-hmm.
So today we have a paradoxical situation of living in cyclic simultaneity. And so every page has aspects of Vico's cycle, Vico's cyclical view of history in it, as well as all aspects of the whole book on the same page. You know, like little blotches,
right.
Like TV dots, pulsating dots of the TV mosaic are on every page.
Okay.
So there is no... And the narrative part, the idea of a story beginning in the third page, is basically the biographical details of Humphrey Chimpanier Wicker and his wife, Anne Olivia Plurabelle, and their three kids, the two twins and the daughter, the two twin sons.
Where does all that start?
That's always in there. But basically, that's one thing I was going to tell you is, that starts on page 30.
Mm-hmm.
Because Finnegan's Wake...
Maybe that's it. The 30 is where it's...
Well, it doesn't really start. What you have is... Finnegan's Wake is also, in Irish cultural history, a takeoff on the song about the Ballad of Tim Finnegan, who's a guy who climbs up a ladder and he falls off the ladder and he dies, and then the people have a wake for him, and at the wake everybody's partying in traditional Irish gaiety and merriment, an alcoholic bottle or whiskey bottle is flung across the partying room and hits the corpse of Tim Finnegan on the head, and he wakes up. And Joyce uses that as a punning parable and metaphor for all the great religions. The idea of the resurrection of Christ, you know, he dies and comes back to life, and all the pagan religions that Christian metaphor comes from. In Egyptian religion and Egyptian mythology, of the fact that the gods, this is what Campbell writes about, that the gods, that the great religious and spiritual leaders were guys who overcame death, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So Joyce makes fun of that with the parable of Tim Finnegan, or the ballad of Tim Finnegan. So what you have is, he takes Tim Finnegan, which is in Irish culture this one man, and he makes him Finn, tribal man. And so from page 3 to page 29, as visual space starts to surface in the second thunder on page 23 and the third thunder on page 44, visual space starts to break up tribal acoustic space and create an individuation, an individualizing, and the private individual, which is represented by Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker and his wife, Anne Olivia Pleurbel. So as the demise of Finnegan happens in the first 29 pages, you have the surfacing of the private individual, or the fragmented eggshell. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He has an ego. McLuhan used to always say ego as ego, as a pun, right?
Mm-hmm.
How's your ego? Is a pun on the Humpty Dumpty fragmented man with the eggshell. So, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker surfaces in page 30, and you have the whole story of from page 30 till 125 is the actually from page 30 to 103 is all about the life of Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker and the various phases he goes through as a tavern keeper, mm-hmm. as a politician, how he's very popular. Then there's a scandal, so then he's put in jail. Like all political leaders of the 20th century, you know, they always end up as terrorists or in jail at one point in their political life, like LaRouche, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's in jail, and then he goes through a trial, and then he resurrects, he escapes from jail. And there's all cross-cultural linguistic parallels with other cultures with this one character, this one figure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about all different kinds of individuals in history. And so he dies and he resurrects. So he replays the ballad of Tim Finnegan. And but on page 104, you begin to hear about his compliment and Livy Pleurbel. And 104 to 125 is all about the manifesto and the letter of Anne Olivia Pleurbel, which is Finnegan's Wig, which is written by Shem, the creative dirty little son, the outcast, but is delivered by the shining perfect boy Sean, his twin brother. He's the mailman. So Anne Olivia, this is the letter that is written, or sometimes interpreted as a letter that the hen found. But Shem writes it, and Sean delivers it, like entertainment sucks. You have a song, Nancy Wilson is a good singer. She has to go through the medium of the mafia, which is the bureaucratic management of entertainment, the money level, which is represented by Sean the postman.
Uh-huh.
And Sean claims that he wrote it. And Shem was the one who wrote it, and he wrote it in relationship with his mother. It's interesting that the traditional idea that the artist is inspired by the muse, which is a female goddess.
Uh-huh.
So there's a close relationship between Anne Olivia and Shem. And Sean is the dream of, is the apple of HCE's eye, right? He's the perfect, successful citizen. And then you have the flirty, silly daughter, Issy, all right? And Issy is a metaphor for all kinds of things. So,
well, like
so that's how Finnegan's Wake. Finn dies before page 30. Tribal man dies as prank queen controlled man, womanly controlled man, the matriarchy controlled man of HCE surfaces, visual bias, leading up to the fifth thunder. There's no Finn. But when you get into the thunders of after the tenth thunder on page 424,
That chapter ends on page 428, and then from 429 to, let me just think it, 429 to 589 approximately, 590. So from 429 to 590, you have the gradual reemergence of Finn, and Finn returns by the last 100 pages of the book, and Finn has come back as a tribal content under the TV effect, and HCE disappears. As a matter of fact, there's a long ham radio put-on section where these ham radio guys are talking, but it's also presented as a seance where originally, and this is part three, there's four books in Finnegan's Wake, and book three is all based around Sean, the four phases of Sean. So Sean has four chapters in book three, which goes from page 403 to 590. And as Sean represents his father, HCE, and goes through these various postures and gets pummeled because he stole Shem's letter, eventually the four masters get past Sean, and they actually get contact with HCE, because in the Sean book, he's riding on his great father, HCE, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker's reputation. So everybody wants to find out what Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker was like. So we find out what he's like, and in the course of analyzing putting HC on the coach, or putting him into a trance situation, and he starts speaking through Sean, he is overcome in the later stages of Book 3 by Finn, the tribal giant. And Finn comes booming through, causing all kinds of earthquakes and revolutions. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so Finn is retrieved. HCE, or the story part of the book, in a sense, you deal with an individual and a bunch of characters.
Right.
That goes from page 30 to, say, 500.
Uh-huh.
But then that's swallowed up. Okay, Carolyn?
Well, Bob, why do you think, what was the motivation in his structuring it so alienating to the normal storytelling tech? Okay.
Why didn't Joyce make a nice effort to communicate?
Yes.
Right. You know why he didn't, Carolyn? Because in the electric age of information overload, or of excessive communication, where everybody's trying to communicate and technology does communicate with everybody to the point where all extrasensorially, telepathically in touch with each other, the only anti-environment stance you could take would be in a massive effort of non-communication,
mm-hmm.
in the age of communication. And that's why Marshall McLuhan once said at a conference of therapists, because I heard this from a psychiatrist on the radio, he was shocked. He was at some seminar, and McLuhan was there, and he said, McLuhan said that in our time, our goal is not to communicate. And this psychiatrist, who makes a career and money out of communicating with his patients on a therapeutic level, was shocked by this. And he said, I think McLuhan was totally wrong. Today, the problem is people don't communicate enough. You know, that cliche.
Yeah.
And we need to communicate more. So you can see which point of view was more long-lasting. We're now sick of people communicating with each other. We don't listen to talk shows. We don't care about them. It's all silly entertainment suck zone. And Marshall and Joyce are right. The real anti-environment and staying power posture is not to communicate, or to develop a way of communicating that makes you aware of the process of communication.
Ah, that clarifies things. Then you're saying often that Joyce, in actuality, invented rock and roll.
No, I said his book predicts rock and roll and the rhythms of it, and the mechanical tactile music of rock and roll is what Finnegan's Wake is written like. If you just take glances at it, it's rock and roll in print. I mean there's so much grunting and syllables and chaos, and I mean you could take the Ten Thunders, or each like 10
electronic screeching guitar notes or guitar chords, right? Nice.
Feedback.
Yeah, feedback. And they do feedback because every thunder assumes and resumes the other thunder. Mm. So, and it's a resonating echo chamber. Echoland is a phrase used all the way through Finnegan's Wake. It is really a little rock and roll echoing, the whole psychedelic echoing effect of electrified music, which he didn't have access to, is the style of Finnegan's Wake. You know what I mean? Isn't that amazing? Is it gonna rain? Here we go, Jerry. We ended with a thunder and a rainstorm, which is what each thunder is in Finnegan's Wake. It's a stormy night, right?
Well, I was going to say, talk about River Run in the metaphor of water.
Oh, yeah. Well, all of nature is metamorphized in Finnegan's Wake. But the water, where just thunder and lightning, Joyce said that he was trying to wake from the nightmare of history. And so the Finnegan's Wake on one level is a man dreaming during a night. He dreams the whole history of man. He's part of it's a nightmare, and he's got all these thunders and noises and rainstorms going through his dream, which we're hearing right now.
Till the end of time, though, is Finnegan's Wake projecting man till, will man ever end?
No. It doesn't end, remember? It doesn't end.
And Finnegan's
Wake does not end with a period.
Right, so Finnegan's
Wake... But
what's
interesting, a few lines before the non-ending ending on page 628, it says, end here. He writes, end here. And that's like a few lines before the actual last words on page 628.
But do you think... Finnegan's Wake will ever be obsolete?
No. It is the new Bible of the future. He has created a new religion, a new myth, just like all the great religions were.
But no new James Joyce will ever come along and write a new Finnegan's Wake?
That is being written by all of us now. That's what Finnegan's Wake means. All of us now, in the global theater, are both actors and audience participating in our own action, in our own participation under electric conditions.
But we're
the
not
computer environment feeds on itself.
But we're not going to create a...
Here comes everybody. Everybody becomes, because you don't need visionary awareness or extraordinary awareness or extraordinary talent to provide content for the electric environment, which creates endless diversity and unity at the same time.
Right, but...
So finally, man is no longer controlled. He's free to co-create and become like a god.
But we're not going to have a book that can be passed down.
No, that book is Finnegan's Wake. That's an endlessly regenerative book.
Okay.
There's millions of personal users, content experiences you can get out of it.
Will man ever be able to read it?
Yeah.
If they
get the basic ground rules, which will help them not be so alienated from it, then they will learn to enjoy it use it.
Is it good that not a lot of people can use it now?
No.
They might be able. More people should use it, and they're just lame because they're not using it.
Well, the problem is the electric environment is driving everybody crazy with too much pattern recognition. To the point we know too much for what we're prepared to understand. So that's why we recommend turning off the electric environment for a little while so people can realize the drug they've been on that's given them the highest decibels of human consciousness and understanding and experience. So people have to realize the drug they've been on. And there was...
Right, but my question was, can man... Should... man be adapting to understanding Finnegan's Wake?
Of course, that's why I did my book. That's why I did my radio show.
Your attempt, but you don't want people to buy your book. It's illegal. You don't want a lot of listeners
I like to have a lot of listeners and people read my book if they made the effort to understand it.
It's just a guide to understanding. So a lot of people should have that kind of understanding.
And their wanting it should come from inside them and not be a fake motivating.
I don't care where it comes from. As long as they make an effort to understand.
Yeah?
There's another point I was going to make. You were saying making everybody understand. What was that? Repeat that question.
Well, the question's sort of hard to verbalize.
Just repeat what you said, because that'll remind me what I was going to tell you. There's another point there.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. And McLuhan wrote a letter to Playboy, which we feature in our third Perfect Pitch. The letter was written in 1970, approximately, where he says that the auditory imagination, which was a term used by and promoted by T.S. Eliot before World War II, is now a cliche awareness. That's because acoustic space is the content of tactile space. So auditory imagination is a cliche situation that offers no perception. It's archetypal. Cliche becomes archetype. The new hidden awareness, which people are not aware of, was the pattern recognition expressed by Joyce in Finnegan's Wake. And he writes to Playboy in 1970 that Finnegan's Wake has not entered the waking life of people in the 20th century. They are not aware of it. It's a hidden environment. It's a hidden organism, a hidden nutrient, a hidden guide to media ecology, just sitting there waiting to be understood. That's why, you know, people like Doug will just read Ulysses. They don't know how to get into Finnegan's Wake.
And so are you here to promote Finnegan's Wake?
Yeah, I'm a Finnegan. I'm here to point out what has been achieved.
So at the funeral, we should whip a bottle at your head?
No. I won't have a funeral.
I knew that was going to... Yay! Bob has just been declared.
Bob will never die.
He's just been declared immortal.
But what I'm
still trying to say, I mean, if you had a zillion dollars, would you promote, you know, buying Finnegan's Wake on the Home Shopping Club on TV?
Oh, yeah.
These guys.
I would
feel that your mission to get people to read Finnegan's Wake?
That's one of my missions. You got to understand that part of the message of Finnegan's Wake is that it's a vast mirroring of nothing by nothing. Because the whole point of Finnegan's Wake is that the last word of perfect language, television and the modern electric environment, is the means to wake people up. And Marshall explained that. The multiplicity of the media experiences we have today will alienate man from identifying with any particular medium so that he will finally get detached from the hypnotic effect of each medium. So the multiplicity of mixed corporate media as an art form is what's creating the collective consciousness of today. And so I don't have to get people to understand Finnegan's Wake. That is being done by the electric environment. The problem is that they cannot see that. They can understand it on a non-visual sensory way, but they don't know how to retrieve their visual sense, which is what is on page 52. Television kills, telephony and brothers broil. The eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. Finnegan's Wake retrieves visual space and shows you how to see the electric Esperanto that has made everybody collectively conscious.
Put that in more layman's terms.
Well, what do you mean?
Why do you use all these big terms? No one would understand what you
Well, it's not hard to understand the word Esperanto. You hear the word, you look it up in the dictionary, you say, oh, that was an attempt to make a universal language. You got to do a little thinking.
I know, but you said television kills.
Well, that's page 52 of Finnegan's Wake. This is an actual quote by Joyce. He's laying out what the book means. He says, television kills, telephony in brothers broil.
What's telephony in brothers broil mean?
Telephony is telephones. Brothers, it's like Cain and Abel. Brothers broil. Broil means a fight.
Okay.
So Cain kills Abel in brothers broil, in brothers fight. But that's an anthropomorphic view of reality. A technological view, as extensions of us, is television kills telephony and brothers broil. It's like a newspaper headline. And then it says, the eyes demand their turn. So he's pointing out the senses. He's pointing out the television is not an extension of the eye, and how the human organism collectively or unconsciously, when a new environment comes in, demands a rebalancing of the sensory structure. It's called sensory closure. And sensory closure is the eyes demanding to be rebalanced with the tactile mesh of television, or to have a function within it. And different cultures express their particular bias in sensory closure in relation to the TV environment. So television kills telephony and brothers brawl. The eyes demand their turn. Joyce then says, let them be seen. So the way to have the eye be seen is to have the eye as an ear, which is what happens under TV conditions, and to express it via the visual eye medium, the book. And so the book consists of a soundtrack separate from a visual track. What you see when you read it is different from what you hear when you read it out loud. So he has found a way. He has solved the modern geometric problem, modern mathematical problem, the scientific problem. The scientists don't even know is a problem yet. He has solved the problem of the 20th century by figuring out how to write a book with the keys given. It's on the last page. The keys to the book are given to you. And also learned how to revitalize the medium of a book itself. That's quite an amazing achievement, eh?
Right. Now, did James Joyce do this because he was just a most incredible writer, or did he actually have some form of ESP? Do you believe he had some form of ESP because he knew this would be an effective work till all, for all time?
Well, I mean, it's like Oliver Stone's movie JFK, which seems amazing to people that all that information was there, and none of the people who see this movie, the vast majority of them, never heard of Mae Brussel, Sherman Skolnick, LaRouche, Dr. Beter, or these various people who knew all this stuff a few years after Kennedy was shot. The knowledge about Mae Brussel, Skolnick is suppressed, just as the knowledge of what James Joyce, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, W.B. Yeats, and Wyndham Lewis knew, and what kind of discourse went on between them at the turn of the century has been suppressed. Marshall's always been pissed off about that. He wrote about it in his letters that what these guys talked about was very close to what Marshall talked about. Marshall retrieved those guys. And what they talked about was suppressed by the spreading of university education, like in medicine. They suppressed the natural therapies when chemistry and Hitler and I.G. Farben took over. The poets of the 30s and 40s, W.H. Auden and E.E. Cummings, and any poets that you talk about in the 30s, 40s, and 50s did not know this knowledge that was lost, and were not able to be as encyclopedic.